I'm John Kroll. Coming up on No Limits, we're talking about the subject no one likes to discuss, the story of the hurts in the home, the issue of domestic violence. It shatters lives and scars families by creating a vicious cycle of despair. We're going to talk today with people who've experienced domestic violence, people who try to treat it, and people who investigate it. And, of course, you. You can call us at 1-866-476-3881, email us at nolimits@wfyi.org, or send questions or comments via Facebook and Twitter at WFYI. Please do join this important conversation. First, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are talking today about the difficult issue of domestic violence. We have as our guests Maddie Harold, a survivor who now works with a batterer's intervention program, and Robin Bennett, who is a police officer, detective, who investigates domestic violence cases. Maddie, Robin, thank you for joining the program. Good to have you both here. I want to talk a little bit, sort of frame this issue by saying that, get some idea of the scope, how common, how large a problem is this? Do we have some numbers? Robin, how many cases do you deal with, would you say?
In 2010, I investigated myself over 300 domestic violence cases. There were 14 domestic violence detectives. Now we are at 17.
So we've added staffing. And I should have said in the intro that you are with the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department. So you're here in the city.
Yes.
So we now have my math skills are a little rusty, but that's like a 20% increase in staffing if you're talking about bumping it up from 14 to 17.
Yes, and also in the city of Indianapolis and the police department, we have taken on all domestic violence incidents. Prior to this year, we were only taking anything that happened up to a D felony. Now we're taking all major assaults, including assaults with weapons, anything short of a homicide.
Okay, so if you did 300 of these last year, is that a typical caseload for all 17 of these folks, or is that?
Yes.
Yeah. So, boy, we're really taxing my math skills here now. But that's nearly 6,000, more than 5,000 cases a year
in Marion
County. Here in Marion County that you investigate, and those are the ones that we know about, right? Maddie Harold, could you talk a little bit about, as I understand it, part of the difficulty of dealing with this issue is that. For all of the cases that we know about, there are a lot more that we don't, where people don't want to talk about it. It's still a subject that people are very uncomfortable disclosing. There's a certain shame and stigma attached with it. Could you speak to that a little bit?
Certainly. Thank you. Many victims don't want to report because, just as you said, there's shame associated with that. What have I done wrong? And who am I going to tell? Who's going to believe me? Particular relationships where there is a prominent figure in their life, you know, that's their partner, who's going to believe that this person would be doing this to me. So, and also that you tend to question and doubt yourself, you know, what did I do? Why would someone treat me this way? I must have done something. I can remember in my particular case, the first time he hit me, I thought, oh my gosh, what happened? What did I do? So you tend to question and doubt yourself in those situations. And so it makes it very difficult then to report to somebody. And there's also that understanding that, you know, this person's going to get in trouble if I report, and then what? You know, I have to be able to take care of my children. I have to have somewhere to live, someone who's going to support, continue to pay bills. And if I report them, then what's going to happen? So there's a lot of fear associated to reporting.
You mentioned, obviously, that you are a survivor of
Correct.
Domestic violence. Could you talk a little bit about the circumstances of that, where Tell us your story.
Okay. I was very young. I was 16 when I met the gentleman that I finally married. I quit school and got pregnant, quit school. We got married. We moved very far away. In the very beginning, he was very charming, and that's typical for a perpetrator. We don't start out in those relationships because someone hits us. We start out because they are charming, because they make us feel good, because they impress us and make us feel good about ourselves. And so you get emotionally involved with that person. So the first time that something looks unusual to you, you don't really pay a lot of attention to that because it was a one-time thing. But over a period of time, what I found was things such as my girlfriends would call and say, let's go to movies. When are we going to do that this weekend? And I say, oh, that sounds really great. And he'd say, oh, well, I kind of wanted to do whatever this weekend. And so in order to not lose that boyfriend, I'd say, well, maybe I'll go with you next time. So we lead ourselves into those relationships, not watching for the red flags that we see and the fear that somebody else might not want to be our boyfriend. And so then, as I said, in my particular situation, we moved very far away from my family. As we were together for about 4 years, and as the time went on, his escalation became more and more. It started out with he'd slap me, and eventually I lost a child when I fell down a stairway. He pushed me down the stairway. So it just escalates. It doesn't start out really terrible and awful, and so it's really hard then, I believe, for the victim in the situation to see just how bad things are sometimes because of that emotional attachment and the fears that we maintain in ourselves.
How long ago was this?
Oh, gee.
Sorry.
That's okay.
Yeah. And thank you for sharing your story with us.
That's okay. Let's see. 40 years ago?
Okay. Well, it's okay. You're younger than I am, I think.
I don't think so.
But I want to talk a little bit about the process that led you to make a change. And I also would like to invite our listeners to join this conversation, to share their stories, too, about this sensitive subject. The problem's not going to get solved if we don't figure out ways to talk about it. So I would like for people to join this conversation. They can do so by calling us at 1-866-476-3881, sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or sending questions or comments via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. So 40 years ago, how did you go through the process then of deciding to get out, and how difficult was that? I'm asking you to share this story because I'm guessing somebody out there listening is in similar circumstances and is looking for a way out.
Well, in that time frame, there were no laws in place that said, you know, if someone in your relationship, there was a problem with, then the police didn't get involved in that unless they actually saw what happened. So I would leave several different times. Over a period of 4 years, I left 6 times. That's the average for most domestic violence victims, by the way. And the last time I left was after an incident where he came home from work. That morning there was a question asked that he didn't like my answer to, and it was simply, if you ever really left me, what would you take? There is no correct answer for that. Mm-hmm. He pulled me out of our bed by the hair of the head and threw me in a closet, kicked me till I couldn't move, and at that point I finally realized I could die at the hands of this man. So he simply walked into the kitchen, put a pot of coffee on. And once I could gather myself and left, I chose then to never go back. Prior times when I would leave, I would say to my family and my friends, you know, we're just kind of going through a rough time. It's no big deal. And then I'd go back, or he would move back in with me.
I'm sorry you had to go through that. I'm sorry. Robin Bennett, what is it like to deal with situations like that as a police officer? What do you do when you're investigating them? How do you... And I guess I'd like to ask, too, how do you deal with somebody who is in Maddie's situation at that point?
Well, Maddie's correct. When I first came on the police department, there were no domestic violence laws set in place. And it was a misdemeanor in this state that you had the witness happen. Even if the victim or the children had injuries, there was little we could do without witnessing it. So when the laws were put into effect and we were trained, it made it easier for us, for the police, when I say us, in some respects, but a lot more difficult because Manny alluded to the relationships that we're dealing with are also emotional relationships. So even though a person is being assaulted, they are depending on this person that is the alleged assailant for their livelihood. The children are witnesses to it. If they leave the relationship, most of the victims are unemployed and undereducated, so they really don't have an opportunity to find work to raise their children and themselves. It's difficult to deal in these investigations because people don't trust the police. Because we are going to, if they cooperate with us, we are going to have to take somebody and incarcerate them for a period of time. What we're trying
to explain there, that it's violence or any crime is not just a crime against an individual, but it's considered a crime against society itself. So at some level, what happens if someone who is in Maddie's situation or whatever calls you, there's an obligation. She can't decide necessarily all by herself to drop the charges or make the thing go away once the process has started. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely not. We take the words off of the we don't call them victims anymore. We call them the state's witnesses. We take the word victim off so that it empowers them as well. Mm-hmm. But it is not incumbent upon the person who is assaulted whether or not charges are filed. It's our job as police and as domestic violence investigators to corroborate the information that they say took place, collect evidence, photos, statements, victims, witness statements, and present a case to the prosecutor. The prosecutor in Marion County determines whether charges are filed or not.
How long have you been a domestic violence detective?
I came to domestic violence in October of 2001. Okay. And I've been there since.
So almost 10 years?
Yes.
And did you choose to do this? Did you apply to do it? I guess what I'm asking is why would you want to do this work? I'm not asking you judgmentally. I'm trying to get at what kind of contribution you wanted to make by doing this work.
Well, as a child, I witnessed domestic violence in my own home. And the powerlessness that my mother felt and my siblings felt, as well as men were patriarchal in the neighborhood I grew up in. So a lot of domestic violence was rampant.
And what neighborhood did you grow up in?
I grew up in Porter County, Indiana, Okay. And everybody was blue collar. And the women stayed home and raised the children and had the home, took care of everything. So I had that desire because I wanted to make a difference and I didn't want any child to have to live the way that I lived. So I became a police officer, and then when domestic violence laws were put into effect, I had a passion to become a domestic violence investigator.
And is it the part of your job? What is the hardest part of your job right now, would you say?
Funding, getting resources, getting the necessary tools that we need to conduct thorough investigations so that we see more convictions and consistency within the domestic violence courts and the Marion County Prosecutor's Office working together with less dismissals.
Okay. And on a personal level, what's the most difficult thing? Is it hard to go in and be in those situations?
No. I separate myself because I have a job to do, and if I become emotional, then I'm not going to be that advocate, that intervener for that family.
Okay. We are talking about the difficult subject of domestic violence. We're fortunate to have as our guest right now Maddie Harold, who is a survivor who now works with the Batterers Intervention Program. We're going to talk a little bit more about that in a moment. And Robin Bennett, who is domestic violence detective with the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department. I'm John Kroll. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We're talking about domestic violence today. Fortunate to have as our guests Robin Bennett, who is domestic violence detective of the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department, and Maddie Harold, a survivor of domestic violence who now works with a batterer's intervention program. Maddie, could you talk to us a little bit about what that program is, the group that you work with?
Certainly. People who are arrested and ordered to our program come in for a 26-week period. It's a cognitive accountability program, and it's about raising my awareness to my actions, taking responsibility for my actions, not blame-shifting what I did or what I said to be someone else's fault. We talk about how we have to look inside ourselves, listen to our conscience, and do the right thing. The baseline for our program is the golden rule. Treat others the way you want to be treated. How is it then that we don't do that? We've learned that, you know, that statement since we were small children. How do we not adhere to that? And over a period of time, our conditioning through the families we grow up in or the neighborhoods we are in changes that. We say things like, it's okay this time, I have a right this time because I don't have to adhere to that because someone made me mad, because someone said something I didn't like, so this time it's okay. So we try to raise their awareness in the saying that we have in our class that we have everybody try to memorize and use all the time is, there is nothing another person can say or do that can make me say or do something my conscience knows is wrong. And once I get that, and I can use that at times when we can feel when we're getting those kind of feelings, that we're feeling angry or that we're not liking what's being said to us or what's going on in front of us. And when we learn to recognize those signals, take 5 seconds or a moment to say that saying, there's nothing another person can say or do that can make me say or do something my conscience knows is wrong, gives me the opportunity to stop, change what my actions might be, change what my words might be, and then accept responsibility for them.
Robin, do you want to add something? Or you look like, for a moment, like you wanted to join the conversation.
Everything that Maddie is sharing is what we share with our victims when we speak to them on the phone to encourage them to tell us their story and to corroborate the initial police report. So I was just agreeing that we use Maddie's style even to deal with our victims mm-hmm. to help them understand that it's okay to tell somebody what happened.
Mm-hmm. I want to invite our listeners to join this conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881 or sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You also can send comments or questions via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I think actually what the two of you are saying has brought us to an interesting point, and I think the great unanswered question here. It's one that Maddie and I actually were talking about off the air before the show, when Maddie, you said that really the question that needs to get asked more often is not why does she stay, but why does someone batter? So I want to, can we address that a little bit? Can we talk a little bit about the reasons that such as they are, that someone resorts to domestic violence with people that he or she supposedly cares about?
Well, that's a vast array of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
I can have a bad day, and because my day is bad, I come home and I take it out on people I love and care about.
Mm-hmm.
I may have been raised in a household where that was what I know. I come home and the scenes in my home are, there's yelling, screaming. That's the way we resolve differences in our home. So as I grow up, my way of knowing what to do is what I've seen done. And so I resolve differences by yelling, screaming, hitting.
Mm-hmm.
If I've not learned something different, that seems normal to me. If I'm a young woman in a relationship or in a family who grows up in that manner, I'm likely to look for that kind of a partner because that's what seems normal to me. And so getting education out into our neighborhoods, making, you know, that type of education awareness in our schools for children at young ages, that this is what domestic violence looks like. This is not a healthy relationship. And so teaching them healthy relationship guidelines. Because if that's normal, I don't know any different. I believe other things is that we tie in, like I said earlier, into that emotional piece. And once that I'm in that relationship, it's real difficult to get out of it.
Robin, when you're investigating this stuff and you're talking with someone who clearly is an abuser, what sort of justifications do they give for their behavior? I mean, I presume at some point you'll ask, why did you do it? Or what did you do? What do they tell you in those cases?
They blame the victim. If she hadn't said this, if she had only cooked what I wanted to eat, it's a lack of self-esteem even for abusers. I think it's a learned pattern of behavior. And I think a lot of the times the abusers have a lack of self-esteem. And they are trying to draw their worth in this world off of their partner. And when the partner doesn't meet their expectations that they've made up in their own mind, it is that person's fault. It's not their own fault.
Maddie, you were practically leaping out of your seat to jump in on that point. So,
well, when she speaks to that pattern, we talk about that same pattern in our class. Pardon me, excuse me. The fact that there's some sort of perceived threat to the person. And when I feel that perceived threat, then fear is the emotion that I get. And if I have fear, then all of a sudden I feel out of control. And my thought pattern is then I have to control somehow. And so I take those measures to make things seem back in control for me. And so when I realize that it's not okay and I feel guilty, I've got to make me feel better for feeling guilty. So I justify the behavior.
Greg, welcome to the program. How are you doing? Are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Oh, thank you for joining us. Thank you for joining us. Understand that that you have a story to tell us.
Yeah.
Yes, I am.
I'm a survivor of...
Greg, could I ask you to turn your radio down? The delay is creating some feedback for us. Thank you.
I'm the survivor of an abusive relationship. However, mine was verbal and emotional. With a woman, they tend not to hit you because they can't, because they're not as big. But it is just as debilitate. And I went through very much what your speaker went through, and it took me a long time to get out of the relationship because I was constantly manipulated. So, you know, I mean, I understand, but, you know, the abuse is physical, sexual, emotional, and verbal, and it's the same. The abuser uses manipulation and force to control the abusee. That's about what I got to say.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you for calling and sharing. We probably should talk. I'm actually speaking to our guests right now. Thank you for calling, Greg. I really appreciate it. Thank you. We focused really on violence here, and that's sort of the subject of the program. But Greg raises a valid point here, which is that, you know, abuse can come in many forms. What definition should we use? I mean, what should we look at as a sign that someone is in an abusive relationship?
Unfortunately,
Robin Bennett. Thank you.
Robin Bennett. Unfortunately, our laws, the Indiana laws, we are geared towards the physical act. But he's absolutely correct. Domestic violence is also verbal, mental, emotional. That there are some laws in place like intimidation. Somebody threatening to kill another person, somebody threatening to assault another person. However, under our statute, there has to be a reason behind it. Just simply telling somebody, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to beat you up, without the threat followed through, like if you call the police, if I end up in jail, we don't have anything to protect that or to arrest somebody. But we deal with those by suggesting that they obtain a protective order. The protective orders are family only now. Years ago, you could get a restraining order against your neighbor if you didn't like their fence. Now protective orders are workplace violence, intimate relationships. And if a person has a protective order and the other person is served, there's any contact at all, even a drive-by, a threat, I will kill you without the reason why, that can be... A person can be arrested for contempt of court out of the civil court the protective order is obtained out of, which is court G21 downtown, or also invasion of privacy, violating an order of protection. Two or more incidents of an invasion of privacy can constitute C felony stalking.
Okay, and what are the penalties for some of these?
An invasion of privacy is a misdemeanor under Indiana state statute. It's up to the judge. You can do up to 90 days in jail for a misdemeanor. That's not likely to happen. But an invasion of privacy conviction in Marion County automatically makes it an enhancement if you're accused again, so you would face an misdemeanor and a D felony on your second accusation. Also, two or more incidents of just an misdemeanor invasion of privacy can constitute, under our laws, C felony stalking.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You also can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Or send comments or questions via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We're talking about domestic violence, and really we've circulated now to the larger topic, really, of abuse and abusive relationships. Mattie Harold, I know you work with batterers, but clearly are familiar with the cycle, really, of abuse and domestic violence. How would you define abuse? What constitutes an abusive relationship?
Anything I say or do that forces my will on another person. And that's what we talk about when we do our definition of violence in our classes.
So it doesn't have to be physical.
No, it doesn't have to be physical. If I'm intimidating to you, if I'm coercing you to do things against your will because it's what I want, that's an abuse issue. The difficulty is we can't intervene. There's, you know, nothing to do prior to it becoming a legal issue. And that's why I think that it's, again, real important that we educate starting in schools, that we do as many educational pieces as we can as a community that says, this is how I recognize if I'm in an abusive relationship. If someone is constantly trying to control who I talk to, where I go, how I spend my money, that's abuse.
What are the step, someone who is trapped in a relationship like this? I guess I'd like to get some useful information out here for people. I mean, Robin, whom should they call? If they want help, whom should they call?
Well, the Julian Center, which is the domestic violence women's shelter, also has an administration side. They can call the Julian Center and talk to an advocate, request to speak to an advocate. I think you can call 211,
yes,
and get information. Our domestic violence office, 327-1211.
Would you mind repeating that number for people?
327-1211 does not necessarily mean that somebody has to go to jail, but we can give information. We can lead them to the resources of the Julian Center. We can explain to them about our outreach advocates, who can contact them. That is anonymous information that will not be divulged to anybody if they speak to an advocate. We can discuss protective order, which are civil protective orders out of Court 21 options. There are different wordings on the protective orders. So there's a lot of information out there. All they have to do is pick up the phone. They don't have to necessarily give their name if they call the domestic violence unit. They can ask to speak to a detective, explain their situation, and get some information.
What can we do to help people who are in this situation? Mattie, what would be the biggest thing that would help? I know Robin's already made a case for more funding here.
Mm-hmm.
And that obviously would be one thing, but it, you know, if we've established anything here, it seems to be that there's a cycle here and that it rotates through the generations. How do we go about intervening? How do we break that cycle?
I think being supportive to the victim, not assuming that I know what's best for her. When a victim leaves that situation, his lethality rate goes up 75%. And I speak to his lethality rate. We you know, it's abuse comes from both genders, but typically it's male against female. So that's why I use that mm-hmm. language. But the lethality rate will go up once the victim leaves because the person who is the abuser has now lost their control. And as I mentioned earlier, that whole situation is about power and control. the feeling that I've somehow lost control, I have to gain control again. Well, if the victim moves out, I've lost a lot of control. So it's really important for the victim to be safe. There are safety plans that they can put into place. As Pam mentioned, you can go to the Jillian Center. You can go online and look for those things. The Indiana Coalition Against Domestic Violence has a hotline number, and you can go to their website. Nonviolent Alternatives also has a questionnaire that you can go to that says, do I have an abuse problem? So someone who is worried maybe about their own behavior, and we do have self-referrals in our program, mm-hmm. can go there and take that quick test. You know, are some of the things I'm doing and saying, are they abusive, and do I need to put myself into check and think about the things that I do and say to people who are in my life?
How many people come to you voluntarily?
That's a tough question. I have a group of 20, and I believe I currently have 4 who are self-referral.
Okay. Who said, I've got a problem. Robin shaking her head and saying...
Yeah, it's not typical.
saying that's the exception rather than the rule. That yes. You got to be dragged to treatment, pretty much.
I laugh because a lot of our alleged victims will tell us, I don't need your help anymore. He's promising to go get mm-hmm. help. That is just another way to control the relationship. Rarely do you see that happen.
And when you're dealing with someone, Maddie, who has been an abuser, what are the first steps you take? What do you start talking with them about?
Well, during our orientation period, when they come to our class, we don't allow them to blame the victim during their, you know, when we ask the question, why are you here? We want to know why they're here. Typically, it's because the court sent me. But when they start mentioning the victim and what she did or what she said, we counteract that and do not allow that blame shifting to continue. And so hopefully during that orientation period, they will get an idea of, I have to take some responsibility here. And that's the goal over the 26-week program.
And how many people do you work with over the course of a year?
Oh, gee, I don't know, to be honest.
Well, and I guess it's part of, we haven't established with your background, how did you make the transition from survivor to being counselor, you know, guide, mentor?
After I left that relationship, for many years, there were things that, you know, I had bad jobs, et cetera. Eventually, I was in a position where I could give back, and I decided that I wanted to do something for other victims because I had been a victim. And so I started doing volunteer work and worked with a shelter.
Was it here in Indianapolis?
It was in Columbus, Turning Point in Columbus. At that time, I lived in Shelbyville, and so I was co-founder of the Domestic Violence Task Force in Shelbyville, and that opened up a lot of more doors for me. And at that time, I met Terry Moore, who had Nonviolent Alternatives, and I went to see his program, and I just thought it was awesome, and I said, I have to work here.
And what satisfaction do you take out of doing it? I mean, my guess is you got to go in and hear horrific story after horrific story day after day.
I think the satisfaction is that we, if nothing else, we plant a seed that says that living this way is not productive for me or for my loved ones, and that there is hope and that there is a way to change. As long as you make the commitment to make the change, we will help you through the steps to do that.
Do either, and I'm asking for a very short answer here because of the time constraints, but do either of you think at times, boy, this is just too much?
There's been once I can think of in my lifetime that it just felt like too much. And fortunately, my higher power was there and said, no, it's not. And I got a letter from someone who had been through our class and said, had I not come through your class, I don't think that I would be where I am today. And I don't think that I would have all I have today. And so they were very grateful for the fact that they had been in our class. In fact, the lead line on was, I think I would be dead today. So I get periodically, we'll get emails or cards or something that says, we have made a difference. And when you know that you make a difference, that kind of a difference, I think you have to keep doing it.
We're talking about the difficult subject of domestic violence here on No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We're talking about the difficult subject of domestic violence. Our guests are Maddie Harold, survivor who now works with the Batterers Intervention Program, and Robin Bennett, who is domestic violence detective with the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department. We're really talking now about the cycle, and I think the part we, you know, so far we've sort of focused on the relationships, you know, primarily between men and women, or at least domestic partners. And, you know, often there is a, you know, another player in all of this, and that is that there are children involved. Robin, you alluded to that, too, and talking about your own situation and your motivation for becoming a police officer. What do we do about the children who are trapped in a home where violence is taking place, and how often are they the victims?
Victims,
I guess they're victims anyway, yes, if they're witnessing it, but victims in the sense that they're the targets of the abuser's anger and violence.
Through a lot of hard work, we were able to effect statutes to encompass the children now. So we do have domestic battery with children present charges that we can arrest for, which makes that a level D felony. If the child is 16 or younger and witnesses it, and that includes a sleeping infant, if a child is present in the home and an assault occurs, that gives us the tools to arrest and charge that crime. We also work hand-in-hand with Child Protective Services now, who have developed a domestic violence unit. Every incident of domestic violence that we investigate or that is reported that has children involved, a 310 is sent to Child Protective Services, which is an information, and they conduct their investigation.
The 310 is an informational report.
To Child Protective Services, and they will have a domestic violence Child Protective Service worker investigate those allegations and go into the home and speak to both the alleged abuser and the alleged victim and the children. Mm-hmm. And children are witnesses, and Maddie alluded to it, learned pattern behavior patterns. The children that are seeing it, now we're trying to get in the middle of it so that we don't lose another child. A child is not injured again or killed because of domestic violence, and that the child sees that there is something that's going to happen. There's a repercussion to the person who put their hands on somebody in their presence.
Mm-hmm. Maddie Harold, how do you deal with women primarily, but as you pointed out, it occasionally they are men who are trapped in these relationships. They have children together, and in effect, the children become kind of hostages in the situation, particularly if there are, you know, financial or economic pressures that sort of. How do we resolve that problem?
I mean, well, I don't work directly with the victims, but there are victim services out there, and they will devise a plan for them, address what issues that they need to, you know, address, such as do they need help financially, do they need to find job stability, that kind of thing. What is it that they can do for the children? They put together a whole plan for the victims in shelters, such as the Julian shelter.
Do we have short-term, you know, like if there is a situation, someone out there right now is listening and thinking, oh boy, you know, this sounds like me, and this is sort of the catalyst for making a change. Are there ways, if they say, you know, I'm not employed, my partner is the one who's, you know, paying the rent, paying the mortgage, putting the food or whatever into the house, I know I'm going to have to do that. How do I get to that point? What steps should she or he take to make that change? Robin Bennett, I mean, I'm assuming you deal with that occasionally, where more than occasionally, where you have to go in and talk to somebody who just feels completely overwhelmed.
We use our outreach advocates who work out of the Julian Center. Again, there's funding and there's money out there. How much is out there, I'm not aware of, but... Mm-hmm. They will come out and work with them. Citizens Gas in the past has helped with bills, IPL, water company, in situations if we can make sure there's no recidivism. We certainly can't go in and help somebody and they're going to allow the abuser to move back in the house. That's another power struggle and control. But outreach advocates at the Julian Center, Indiana Coalition Against Domestic Violence, 211. That's the number you can dial on the phone, 211, and they will answer your questions or lead you to somebody who can help you.
We're talking about the difficult issue of domestic violence with our guest, Maddie Harold, who is a survivor and now works with a batterer's intervention program, and Robin Bennett, who's a domestic violence detective with the Indianapolis Marion Metropolitan Police Department. And I would like to invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881, sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or sending comments or questions via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We've talked a little bit about the sort of proactive steps that we can take with this and attempting to break the cycle. Are there public policy things that we could do that would help? I mean, Robin, you've alluded to not just the funding question, but really whether the laws should be at some level more sophisticated in terms of dealing with this. Do you feel like you have the tools now that you need to protect victims, or are there other changes in the code you think would be helpful? I know that's a tough question. So.
It's a tough question because most of it depends on what happens in the courtroom. Our hands are tied as investigators. We put the case together. The Marion County Prosecutor's Office determines what charges or whether they will be filed mm-hmm. or not. But the courts are so overloaded that there's a lot of times that we're dismissing cases where we have a great opportunity to get in the middle of it when it's just, and I don't want to minimize, but when it's just a slap that has a bruising before it rises to the level of criminal confinement, a use of a deadly weapon, injury to a child. So I think we need to take a look at, and I'm a big proponent of domestic violence diversion courts. They have worked in
Can
other states.
Can you explain what those are?
It's where you work with the victim, the alleged assailant, and the children, but instead of getting the conviction on the record for the person who is accused of the crime, they admit to their part in the crime or that they committed the crime, and they successfully complete a batterer's intervention program. Domestic violence counseling is what we call it. And if they successfully complete it, then it does not show up as a conviction of domestic battery. One of the problems that we have is domestic battery is a misdemeanor, but a person who's convicted of that forever surrenders their right in the state of Indiana to carry a firearm. A lot of people don't want to plead guilty to that.
Lynn, thank you for joining the program.
Hi. I had a question.
Sure.
It seems that nowadays we're seeing the violence go to younger and younger ages, down into teenagers. And I was wondering, my daughter had a situation and she's gotten away from the offender, but now she's being harassed by the offender's entire family, threats by siblings. And I was wondering, are there protective orders and things for her?
Yes.
Good question. Robin Bennett, the simple answer is yes, but how do you go about accessing those?
Definitely. Whenever there's an intimate relationship involved, including just a dating relationship, and although she's a minor, you as her parent can accompany her to Court G21. It's in the basement of the city county building. There's an intake office. You explain what is going on. They can issue the protective order to the former boyfriend, which would also encompass his family. There's an advocate there that will speak with you about it. And then any violations that they would commit, you would call the courtroom and or make a police report. There are civil penalties and criminal penalties attached to the violation of it. But, yes, she can get a protective
okay.
order.
I've been sending documentation to her school counselor, so would we need to bring any of that with us?
Yes. It's a civil order, so it's only preponderance of the evidence that you bring. The judge will grant the order as ex parte. Without
okay.
a hearing, and then they will have a hearing. If he responds in court, he'll have a chance to say his say. But I think you're going to be fine if you go to Court 21. They're going to help you.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you for the call, Lynn. Take care. And that raises another question. You know, it's not just about the people who are in these relationships or even the children. What should, you know, suppose I see a friend or a coworker or an acquaintance, and I'm trying to figure out what should I do here? I think there's something not right here. What avenue do I have at that point? Maddie, you are nodding your head up and down, so I'm going to throw the question to you.
I think first and foremost is be supportive of that friend, that family member. Let them know that you are concerned with their welfare. Again, do not assume that you know what's best for them. Suggest that there are places that they can get help, you know, by calling 211, by talking to someone at the Jillian Center. Resources from ICADV, which is the Indiana Coalition Against Domestic Violence. But don't assume that you know what's right for them. And don't tell them you need to get out of this relationship, because you don't know what's right at that point in time. Only the victim, only the person in that relationship knows how volatile it is, knows how dangerous it is at the moment, and when it is the safest time for them to leave. And there are a lot of things that need to be put into place for them to do that. Safety planning is really, really important for the victim's welfare. I think the other thing is, when you had spoke to earlier, what is it we need as a just a senior, you know, a citizen in our community? We need to be involved in volunteering. We need to be involved in educating ourselves and our family members as to what abusive relationships are. Make sure that we get that education into our children at the youngest age possible to avoid dating violence, which we're seeing more and more of, to avoid relationships that bloom into marriages that perpetrate this violence through the generation.
Is Lynn's point that she was making been your experience too, Robin Bennett, that this problem seems to be drifting down younger and younger, that you're seeing more of it among teenagers than you used to?
No, I think it's being reported and brought to light more and more. I think it's been going on for a long time, but I think there have been a lot of different venues of media and billboards and TV and radio that have brought it to light, that help people feel more comfortable. The fact that we're talking about it today is a big deal, because it wasn't talked about, spoken of. It was personal.
You stay right here in the home. You don't take this outside the home.
And make no mistake about it, there are many, many unreported incidences that are happening in that home before the police ever find out. Very violent incidents, probably threats to kill, probably use of deadly weapons that we never learn about. And then when the person finally makes that police report, that is probably, I don't know, maybe the 100th or more time that something has happened.
This might be an intrusive question, Robin, but I'm going to ask it anyway, because I'm curious. When you'd mentioned at the top of the program that you had experience with this, that you'd grown up, did your mother or anybody in your family ever try to call for help?
No, you didn't. It was a personal matter. It was a family matter. Windows were shut when the screaming was going on. It wasn't just my home. It was just the way it was. And no, you wanted somebody to help. You wanted somebody to come in. Most of it was verbal, emotional, and mental abuse that carries on. And by the grace of God, it didn't carry on where I committed those acts in relationships. But it affected me greatly. And I can understand, and I can sympathize and empathize with people who are living that life, because I lived it firsthand.
Yeah, it is. And what when somebody shares a story with you, Maddie, similar to Robin's and similar to your own, how should if I'm a caring friend and somebody comes to me and says, "This is what I'm dealing with."
Empathize with them. Tell them that. Don't ever say, "I know how you feel." We don't know how they feel. Mm-hmm. I'm a survivor. Pam has witnessed the same kind of thing. She doesn't know how I feel. Mm-hmm. So, but empathize and let them know that you care about them. Ask them, what is it you would like for me to do for you? Is there something I can do for you? Don't assume we know what we can do for them.
Yeah, it's about empowering. Yes
empower them.
Yes.
I want to make a point about that,
Robin,
as well.
Bennett. Yeah.
People get frustrated. Mothers get frustrated. Family members get frustrated when the victims go back. And I try to tell them, keep the door open, no matter what your personal feelings are or how you think they should react. If you close that door on them or are judgmental, you're never going to know when they really need you. So lay your frustration somewhere else. because you're not living in that home. You're not experiencing the terror that they're experiencing. Keep your ears open, your doors open, no matter how many times they go back.
Or, frankly, having to deal with the kind of emotional entanglement. We assume that, you know, just because someone is abusing you, that you don't care about that person anymore, and that really is not the case.
No,
that they continue having those feelings even in dreadful circumstances.
It's not you that I don't like. It's your behavior I don't like.
Yeah. And how often are these relationships, in your experience, Maddie, able to be repaired at any level? I mean, once it escalates to violence, is it possible at all, or is that a...
Oh, I think it's always possible, but I think it takes a commitment to change. And again, I have no statistical data to back that up.
In your experience, just from what you've seen.
I know many of our people who complete the program are still with their significant others. We get good reports back that things have changed. We don't keep that kind of data, and I hope that some point in time that, you know, that would be possible to do. But I believe change is possible for anyone who wants to change.
Thank you both very much for coming in here and talking with us about this. I really appreciate it. Our guest today, when we've been talking about the subject of domestic violence, has been Maddie Harrell, a survivor who now works with the Batterers Intervention Program, and Robin Bennett, who is a domestic violence detective with the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department. Thank you both. It's been a pleasure talking with each of you. We are going to talk next week about the hot topic of public smoking bans. We're going to have people who are going to be on every side of the issue. We hope you will join us for that conversation. Please do send us your questions and comments about the public smoking ban to our email address at nolimits@wfyi.org. I am John Krall, Director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism. It's been a pleasure spending this hour with you.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Radio, 90.1 FM and HD1. Producer, Sharon Allseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Cedric Freeman. Board Engineers, Matt Sosi and Josh Hamig. And Intern, Monica Schwab. We invite you to join us each Thursday at noon for No Limits, and you can listen online at WFYI.org.